My name is Michael McCusker. Well, my computer crashed Sunday after I unwisely relinquished security programs and updates I considered a mafia protection racket. If you don't pay for security, then the so-called security outfit will infect your computer. I'm half Sicilian, so I'm rather familiar with such protection rackets. I was planning to engage security I thought might be more honest, and also I thought was free of charge, but it wasn't. The attack on my computer was as abrupt and surprising as a Viet Cong ambush, which is my personal analogy, having had experience. And I didn't have a chance to protect myself. Icons suddenly appeared on the screen like unwanted pimples. Flashes of security warnings followed, but instantly vanished as the screen froze. I am afraid I might have lost at least two articles I was writing for resumption of my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, and perhaps everything else in my documents. This does put back for a while printing the resurrected Times-Eagle, though I hope most of what I have already copyset of other articles will be salvaged, because they have been printed into hard copy or sent to another computer through an electronic seed pod. And serendipitously, I received, about a day after the computer crashed, a March issue of Vanity Fair, which a friend of mine has had a subscription for me for a number of years. And it was the very controversial March issue, which one of the controversies was they seemed to have missed about a million or so subscribers. And so I got a special mailing once it was notified. This is called Ringside at the Web Fight by Michael Wolff, who's a regular columnist for Vanity Fair, or writer, contributor. They're all, you know, editors of one sort or another. Everyone's betting on the internet's next big thing. The author, Michael Wolff, provides a tip sheet on competing theories. It's the platform, Google, Facebook. It's the machine, whatever. It's digital behavior, Twitter. It's porn, Skype, sex, etc. Along with its own hunch about the year to come. That's the subhead. I am told so many things about what is going to happen in the internet business, happen imminently, happen in a way to transform human behavior and aspirations, happen in a way to disrupt the powers that be or to restore the powers that used to be, that I should be in a position, if I could just focus my attention, to get rich, finally. Everybody I know who follows the next big thing believes that this year, emerging from recession, with the death of so many aspects of conventional media, will be a year of, in internet speak, radical inflection, precipitating a wave of acquisitions and IPOs and a river of new investment. If you can only focus on what so many geniuses are saying, you can win big. But deciphering the chatter is no small talent, because the technology business is at least as much talk as it is science. The next big thing can sometimes feel like the coming of Christ, but it can also feel like the internecine debates about socialist doctrine that famously took place in the cafeterias of City College in New York in the 1930s, which nobody needs to be reminded was the last depression. So what I'm going to do here, rather in an effort to create a next big thing for dummies, is to try to align the factions, parse the theories, distinguish the geek Lenins from the geek Trotskys, and offer the possibility for you to profitably know what this year is going to bring, or anyway, hold your own at a cocktail party. Actually, start with a Russian. Yuri Milner is a 48-year-old Muscovite billionaire and Putin lookalike, who in the past has become one of the largest investors in digital media in the United States, elevating the next big thing to something like geopolitical status. Other Russian billionaires buy sports teams or newspapers. Milner is buying platforms, and that's in quotes. Milner is the biggest outside investor in Facebook, and in December, he bought a large share in Zynga, the fastest-growing online game company, whose games, Farmville, Cafe World, and Mafia Wars, are played mostly through Facebook. He says he's betting on personalities. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, and Mark Pincus, who heads Zynga, which is something investors often say. It's also about talent and drive, but a platform bet suggests a view beyond just gifted management. It's a control the universe play. Having a platform in this geopolitical theory makes you a superpower. Microsoft achieved world domination with Windows when operating systems were the ultimate platforms. But a platform is now a more metaphorical construct, suggesting not just functionality, but a framework of behavior, and even a point of view that habituates users and fosters their dependence with an eye toward subsuming the rest of the digital world, like Google, and, in Milner's view, like Facebook, or, in Steve Jobs' view, the iPhone, another stab at his dream of controlling both the hardware and the software that controls the world. The platform theory of global conquest holds that internet dominance has, other than for Google, been elusive, in part because of constant shifts in technology. But the internet, after 15 years, has, in the platform supremacy perspective, come to a level of maturity. The net is now just another utility, like electricity, water, etc., says Mark Kuban, who made one of the biggest personal fortunes of the dot-com boom when he and his partner, Todd Wagner, sold Broadcast.com to Yahoo for $6 billion in 1999. In other words, if you can become an ubiquitous, octopus-like, hydra-headed, chameleon-ish, integrated horizontal and vertical database and command center, it could be years before a new technology challenges your dominance. Which is why the emergence of another platform is so compelling. Facebook's move at the end of last year to revise its privacy settings, an illusory offer of more control to the user, was really part of an ongoing attempt to make more user data public, shareable, and searchable, meaning Facebook has the opportunity to become the platform through which we search not just public information, but individual information, ever-growing masses of it, including pictures. Search moves from the web into people's lives. This prospect leads, in just about everybody's estimation, to an IPO for Facebook this year, which, in its size and giddiness, will transform the industry with new liquidity and provoke the ultimate superpower platform war, a face-off between Google's dominance over web page search and Facebook's command for, or of, the social graph, and that's in quotes. And yet such platform politics, such continuing belief in the possibility of control, may be just so cold war. The better way to look at what changes the game, according to a group you might call the digital behaviorists, part hucksters and part self-appointed sociologists, is to understand how the internet radically alters the desires and habits and actions and reactions of the people who use it. Clay Shirky, for instance, the author of Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations, is a man whose name is now uttered in technology circles with the kind of reverence with which left-wingers used to say Herbert Marcuse. Web 3.0 is not an upgrade, it's a revolution, says Shirky characteristically. Shirky, along with Jeff Jarvis, a Cotton Mather or Billy Sunday figure, who has turned his Sky is Falling lectures to old media executives into a lucrative consulting practice to old media businesses, Chris Anderson, Wired's editor-in-chief, and Jay Rosen, an NYU professor, all dedicated bloggers and, in internet parlance, quote monkeys, have essentially morphed the anarchic 60s-style whole earth catalog roots of the internet into aggressive business theory. At its heart, the digital behavior theory is that the old media business imposed an unnatural behavior on its users, not least of all a strict divide between creators and audience. The internet, with a flat hierarchy, cheap distribution, and virtually no production barriers lets people express themselves more naturally. We are collaborative animals, it turns out, and joyful amateurs interested in more in entertaining and informing ourselves than in being entertained and informed by professionals. Shirky's research actually concludes that people like to work for free and that they are more productive when they do so, which, if you think about it, challenges all economic theory. But if you think about it some more, just says people like their hobbies and are particularly proud of having an autodidactic expertise, which means, you know, self-learning. So what happens when you harness all the world's hobbyists and autodidacts into a new business model? DIGG, for one, and that's D-I-G-G, wherein users select and rank news, which, without one editorial employee, has more than 40 million users, making it one of the biggest news sites on the internet, producing a version of news that no professional would ever create. Or Charlie Bit My Finger, and that's a quote, wherein, or I should say that's in quote marks, wherein a British toddler bites his deadpan brother's finger to great merriment, which, with 149 views on YouTube, is bigger than the Super Bowl. And if this obsessive disgorging and contributing produces, as Jarvis acknowledges, a mountain of crap, this just means the next big thing will be about sorting, sifting, and filtering the crap. Even the need for filters and editors in the behaviorist scheme will be met by a product of the new behavior, Twitter. Twitter, according to the behaviorists, is both the finest expression of free labor and infinite disgorgement, and the way we will navigate through ever greater vapidness and clutter. Twitter is, for the behaviorists, a second-by-second, real-time database of the human experience, a searchable record of all thoughts and actions, which will generate, according to BizStone, its co-founder, 1 billion search queries a day in the coming year. Instead of Google algorithms establishing the information hierarchy, the mass of Twitter-centric humanity, or one's pre-selected peer group among Twitter-centric humanity, will establish what's important and hence what comes up first in search results. Email and IM have morphed quite naturally into a much broader and more open public discourse, says Stone, a discourse which in itself becomes a primary navigation tool and a way, quote, well beyond entering a term in a box and clicking a button, unquote, of interacting with the information world. The live internet, in the behaviorist eyes, is the next big thing. Websites and web pages are out of date. Google, says John Borthwick, whose BetterWorks is a venture capital firm that invests solely in behaviorist business models, still thinks of the world as pages. And that's Bothwick. In Jarvis's declaration, media is no longer a product. It is not a production. It is not a box office hit. It is how we contribute to and how we benefit from our collective expressiveness. Which, according to various done-it-and-seen-it-all types, is a lot of hooey. Or to the extent it is true that the costs of production have gone down and the available labor market has increased, it's all about a cost savings opportunity. Making media in this calculation is, as it has always been, about aligning costs and revenues. The problem is that in an online world, where advertising rates are often 10% of what a comparable television or print audience might get you, costs are out of whack with the most optimistic revenue expectations. Old media guys are always asking, says Shirky, when will revenues rise to meet our cost structure? The answer, I say, is when hell freezes over. This, then, has created the pay-as-you-go theory of the next big thing. Barry Diller, who has perhaps experimented with more theories of the next big thing than any other media and internet magnate, he tried local online media, once believed in the killer future of e-commerce, then tried search with ask.com, is returning to a basic cost and revenue theory of media. Everything old, he says, is new again. The Diller-backed collegehumor.com has become a company, he says, modeled on the early movie studios. It produces an expanding range of videos using acting, writing, and technical talent, which is on hand, and almost all of which is under 30, that is, cheap talent, with Diller's company, IAC, owning all the rights. Likewise, Diller has just joined with former NBC head and reality TV impresario, Ben Silverman, to create a company which, Diller says, returns the media model to the 1950s. When sponsors, such as Procter & Gamble, with soap operas, underwrote and often owned the shows. Even the Daily Beast, the online magazine in which Diller has invested heavily, is a revenue experiment. Diller says he refuses to take low-priced advertising. Rather, he's trying to create a showcase for ads around which lightning might strike, and that's a quote, and, in the manner of old media, vast amounts of merchandise might move. Nick Denton, the founder of Gawker, has applied even more strictly the rules of pay-as-you-go to create what might be the most successful original content company on the web. His is an old media approach, in which media workers are not in the least glamorous or cosseted, but rather hack-like and expendable. But Denton's model is relatively humanistic compared with the even more advanced pay-as-you-go ones. Demand media, for instance, a kind of old-fashioned Sunday supplement multiplied a millionfold, harnesses Shirky's free internet workers and changed them to algorithm which looks at the search streams, figures out the most valuable search terms, then orders up content keyed to those words and works aggressively to push these cheaply manufactured content nuggets up to the top of the search results, where they attract traffic which is then funneled to advertisers. In this view, needing human beings to create content is a minor inconvenience, which will be sorted out over time by algorithms. But then there's the expensive content counteroffensive, the theory holding that the next big thing is big media. However challenged, big media in this view still holds a monopoly, which, if it just shows some teeth and gumption, can prevail over Google, changes in audience behavior, and even the internet's everything-free culture. Five companies, Time, Warner, Disney, Viacom-CBS, Comcast, NBC Universal, Fox, control 85% of video viewing hours in America, says the media analyst Craig Moffat. At the end of the day, this train ain't going anywhere that those five companies don't agree to. This sense of last chance has suddenly given old media a new militancy and belief that it can disrupt the disruptors. It is behind Rupert Murdoch's declaration that he will put a paywall around his company's online content. And it is behind Comcast's deal for NBC Universal. Damn it, brand name content is king. There is even a sense in some old media circles that Google is on the run, or that while old media may be losing its audience and its profits, it still maintains its influence, not least of all in Washington, and after several years of awe and wonder with regard to Google, it is now directing its fire against the company. This, many people believe, means that the next big thing will be an agreement by Google, ever aware of the antitrust litigation which so sapped Microsoft a decade ago, to pay for the right to feature the high-value content that people most often search for. And if that doesn't work, there is the magical machine theory, or the build-your-own-platform solution. In this analysis, a dedicated machine can reclaim the distribution monopoly that was so rudely taken by the internet, or at least let you cut a better deal than you cut with the last machine. There's the Kindle. There's the Barnes & Noble Nook. There's the iPhone. Every old media company has its own iPhone app. And the promise of an Apple tablet. The problem here is, obviously, the problems of too many machines. You can read the New York Times for 75 cents an issue on the Kindle, or you can get it free on the iPhone. There is, too, the behaviorist dismissal of the magical machine solution. The magical device, says Jarvis, is called the internet. Any attempt, in other words, to control the packaging and the distribution channels must ultimately bring you back to a networked world, which is unpackaged and disaggregated. Oh, and then sex. The internet's most motivating application. And Skype. And Skype sex. eBay bought Skype in 2005, a bad match, which stalled the growth of the free phone with video internet service. At the end of last year, its founders repurchased it, which could put Skype back on the next big thing track as the platform for real-time media. It's Twitter as video, soon to be shareable and searchable. And then the status quo, always among the most powerful forces. That is, it's Google's world and we just live in it. What most of us don't notice is the relentless pace of Google search, that it is moving rapidly to colonize real time and to subsume Facebook and Twitter before they subsume it. Hence, don't fight it. So announce yourself as a proponent of the platform theory, or sign on as a rabid internet behaviorist, or a no-baloney cost-cutter, or a Murdochian big media avenger, or a new machine enthusiast, or a believer in the power of Eros as the prime mover of technology, or that what's good for Google is good for America. And I invite you to hypothesize with me that this year, Facebook will buy Twitter, that Google will buy Skype, or to hedge my bets, vice versa, and that search will make its way into our collective emotions and psyche. If you're not searchable, says Jarvis, you'll never be found. And that, because while behavior certainly changes, it also remains the same, there will emerge online program formats and even a daytime and a prime time, all produced incredibly cheaply. But I fear what I have not communicated about the vagaries of the next big thing is exactly what you might miss in a description of all the varieties of socialism that did battle once upon a time behind these theories of how this new world will be organized and how best it will serve humankind lies a Manichean struggle that pits good against evil, control against freedom, one man's establishment against another's new order, with every entrepreneur and engineer believing that he or she can run your life better than any other entrepreneur or engineer, and certainly better than you. And that was Michael Wolff, Ringside at the Web Fight. And it's in the March issue of Vanity Fair. Now, along the same subject, I would like to read something out of Newsweek for March 1st, 2010, which I received in my little slot this morning, again, serendipitously. Google's Orwell Moment. On the Web, Privacy Has Its Price, by Daniel Lyons. Google recently introduced a new service that adds social networking features to its popular Gmail system. The service is called Buzz, and within hours of its release, people were howling about privacy issues because, in its original form, Buzz showed everyone the list of people you email most frequently. Even people who weren't cheating on their spouses or secretly applying for new jobs found this a little unnerving. Google backtracked and changed the software and apologized for the misstep, claiming that, gosh, it just never occurred to us that people might get upset. The public reaction was something we did not anticipate, but we've reacted very quickly to people's unhappiness, says Bradley Horowitz, Vice President for Product Management at Google. It's hard to imagine Google could have been so clueless. Google's coder kiddies may be many things, but stupid isn't one of them. Same goes for Facebook. In December, Facebook rolled out a new set of privacy settings. A spokesman says the move was intended to, quote, empower people, unquote, by giving them more granular, and that's a quote, control over their personal information. But many viewed the changes as a sneaky attempt to push members to expose more information about themselves, partly because its default settings had lots of data, like your phone, like your photo, city, gender, and information about your family and relationships, set up to be shared with everyone on the internet. Sure, you could change those settings, but it was still creepy. Facebook spokesman says the open settings reflect shifting social norms around privacy. 5 years after Facebook was founded, he says, we've noticed that people are not only sharing more information, but also are becoming more comfortable about sharing more information with more people. Nevertheless, the changes prompted 10 consumer groups to file a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission. Maybe it's a generational thing. People at my age, nearly 50, aka the olds, and that's a quote, in blogosphere parlance, would probably rather part with a few bucks than with our personal information. Younger people don't have as much money and don't care as much about privacy, so they're happy to go along with the deal being offered to them by Google and Facebook. What's happening is that our privacy has become a kind of currency. It's what we use to pay for online services. Google charges nothing for Gmail. Instead, it reads your email and sends you advertisements based on keywords in your private messages. The real holy grail is your list of friends. With that information, marketers can start sending more targeted messages. If you like a certain movie or album or mountain bike, your friends will probably like those too. So they'll be good targets for ads for those products. Of course, your friends are not going to buy everything you do. It's not pinpoint accuracy, but the data helps marketers narrowcast, and that's a quote, their advertising. And it sure beats buying commercials on TV or splattering ads all over the internet. The genius of Google, Facebook, and others is that they've created services that are so useful or entertaining that people will give up some privacy in order to use them. Now the trick is to get people to give up more, in effect, to keep raising the price of the service. These companies will never stop trying to chip away at our information. Their entire business model is based on the notion of monetizing, and that's a quote, our privacy. To succeed, they must slowly change the notion of privacy itself, the social norm, as Facebook puts it, so that what we're given up doesn't seem so valuable. Then they must gain our trust. Thus, each new erosion of privacy comes delivered, paradoxically, with rhetoric about how Company X really cares about privacy. I'm not sure whether Orwell would be appalled or impressed. And who knew Big Brother would be not a big government agency, but a bunch of kids in Silicon Valley. The problem with buying things with your privacy is you really don't know how much you're paying. With money, $5 is $5. But what is the value of your list of friends? If it's not worth much, your membership on Facebook may be the deal of a lifetime. If it's incredibly valuable, you're getting massively ripped off. Only the techies know how much your info is worth, and they're not telling. But the fact that they'd rather get your data than your dollars tells you all you need to know. And that was Google's Orwell Moment on the Web, Privacy Has Its Price, by Daniel Lyons in the March 1st, 2010 Newsweek. So, I was thinking about an article, and I'm just going to read the last of it by John Perry Barlow, which he wrote in 2006. If the United States succeeds in censoring the net, it will be in a position to achieve far more than smut reduction. Any system of control that can stop us from writing dirty words online is a system that can control our collective conversation in other more important ways. If the nation states perfect such methods, they may own enough of the mind of mankind to perpetuate themselves far beyond their usefulness. If that sounds overstated to you, consider the millions of people one prosecutor in Germany was able to mute with little more than an implied threat in 2006 when he managed almost casually to strike a global blow against freedom of expression. And he did this merely by telling CompuServe, the world's second largest online provider, that it was breaking Bavarian law by giving Germans access to Usenet discussion groups believed to include explicit sexuality. And John Perry Barlow, he wrote this for Time magazine in January 1996. I don't have the time to read it completely, so I read the gist, which were the last couple of graphs. He calls them the jackboots of the industrial era, who can be heard stomping cluelessly around the Infobahn, and that's in Germany. So at any rate, this has been Michael McCusker. Until next week, if the sky doesn't fall or a truck hit me, I'll be talking with you. Good morning.